You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. During World War II, thousands of Japanese Americans were ordered by the United States government to be incarcerated in remote camps. Now, that order was meant to prevent Japanese people on American soil from taking up arms and bringing the war inside the U.S. borders. Well, today, that period is recognized as one of the most shameful in American history. One of those sites is right here in Idaho. Minidoka housed about 14,000 Japanese Americans in its 3 years of operation. One of those buildings where these folks were housed has been fully renovated, and it is now open as the new permanent visitor center. Back in October, I got the opportunity to talk with a few people involved in this project. Hanako Wakatsuki is the Chief of Interpretation and Education for Minidoka National Historic Site. Mia Russell is the Executive Director of the Friends of Minidoka. And Wade Vigas is the National Park Superintendent who oversees the Minidoka Historic Site. I started by asking Mia about who the people were who were incarcerated at Minidoka.
Sure. So at Minidoka, most of the population that was forcibly removed to southern Idaho originally came from the Seattle and Portland communities. In addition to that, there were also several hundred Japanese Americans from Alaska and 600 or so from California. But these were people that had settled in the United States around the turn of the century. So the immigrants that came to the States in, you know, the late 1800s, and they've set up roots for decades in the U.S., and their children are all American citizens. And of course, their life just changed following December 7th.
And one of the, I remember having some folks on and within the last year or so talking about the internment camp. And one of the things that struck me was that there were Japanese Americans who were soldiers fighting in World War II. And when they would be on leave and they would come home, they would go to the internment camps. I mean, that is where they had to go if that's where their families were. And Mia, saying that is just shocking, but that's actually some of the people who were incarcerated as well, correct?
That's correct. Actually, if you visit Minidoka today, one of the main features near the entrance of the site is a reproduction honor roll. And these were common throughout the United States during World War II. And I think Minidoka's honor roll is really moving to consider because it's the name of all of the people who joined the United States military service from a United States concentration camp. And that was created during the war to honor them by their families who were left behind at the camp. And that was one of the first projects that Friends of Minidoka took on to reconstruct and pay respects to at the site today.
And in the 3 years that the camp was incarcerating Japanese Americans, I think there's not a lot known about these internment camps, especially if we look at them in regards to the internment camps in Europe with the Holocaust. What were the conditions in Minidoka? And that is the whole point of looking at both of these. We know how awful the conditions were over in Europe. Did we see similar things at these internment camps as well? I mean, and first and foremost, it doesn't matter how bad they were. People were being held against their will.
Yeah, so I'll take that question. So on the mainland U.S. with the incarceration sites, especially with Minidoka, there was actually an interview that was done with the military personnel at the time by the Times News. And essentially, the journalist was asking, like, how much energy and effort was being put into these sites? And essentially, the answer was enough to be seen as American, but not enough to be questioned by the taxpayers. So that was the bare minimum. And if you're trying to do a compare and contrast with the incarceration sites on the European front, it's like a lot of people, when they hear the term concentration camp, they immediately think about the Nazi death camps. And that's almost a euphemistic term for that, right? Where people just make that assumption. But there were over 16 different types of facilities in Europe, you know, everything from basically concentration camps that concentrated people to labor camps to death camps. You know, I talked to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and they have identified that they have been using the euphemistic term to describe all the camps, and they have been going through their interpretation to actually kind of correctly identify the different sites that they're referring to. You know, with the Japanese American incarceration history, there were many different facilities as well. There were temporary detention facilities, and then what academia now calls for the 10 war relocation centers, which Minidoka is one of them, as American concentration camps. So those are kind of the difference of the types, and quality of life out here wasn't that great because most of the people were coming in from the urban areas of Seattle and Portland, and they're getting brought into the high desert of Idaho, not knowing for how long they're going to be here, the duration, because immediately with the executive order, most people are given between like, you know, a few days to a week to vacate their property to a temporary assembly center, but the government didn't tell them for how long. So when you look at people coming out, most of them had only clothes for the springtime. So especially when they came to Idaho, the first winter got down to negative 22 degrees. So they didn't even have enough clothing to keep themselves clothed because, or warm, because they didn't have access to those clothes. And especially coming from a coastal environment to this environment was really drastic. So they actually had to bring World War I surplus to help clothe people during that time. So there was a lot of hardships, you know. Yes, they got fed. Yes, they had some aspects of healthcare, but it wasn't the best quality. There was a lot of food poisoning that occurred. The quality of food wasn't that great. There's a story about a woman who was pregnant walking to the hospital. She walked about, I think, a few miles and went to knock on the door, and the doctor turned her away because they're closed. And so she ended up walking back, giving birth to her child. So, so it was hard for people to kind of go from, you know, if they're in the urban areas, having their own space to this communal lifestyle that they were forced into.
So Wade, let's talk about the project itself, about the visitor center. So we know that the renovation itself was a years long process. So what changed, and what led to the Park Service taking on this project?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, at Minidoka during the period of incarceration, there were more than 600 buildings. And then in the years following the closing of the camp and the farm in a day movement, the changing of that high desert landscape from sagebrush and lava rock to productive agriculture lands, a lot of those buildings that once existed for that 3.5 years during the camp were removed. They were trucked off, they were disassembled and reassembled elsewhere. And so when the National Park Service, when Minidoka became a unit of the National Park Service in January of 2001, there wasn't a lot left. And in fact, there was a historic masonry work at the entrance to the camp. There were the warehouse itself, the root cellar, et cetera. But that was really about the extent of what was left. And so what today we know as the visitor center, during the period of incarceration, was known as warehouse number 5. And so the camp was crescent shaped, about 36 residential blocks around it. In the center of it were the warehouse area. And I believe there was 14 or 16 warehouses. They were basically all demolished, disassembled, or removed, except for approximately 50% of warehouse number 5. And so you could picture approximately a 50 by 50 wooden structure, about 20 feet tall in the center, with a slight sloping roof to the north and to the south. That was really all that was left. And so when the general management plan for the site was written and the park began to evaluate, how are we going to tell this story of the unjust incarceration of Japanese Americans following the bombing of the Second World War, it became, I think, really clear to those NPS officials at the time that the warehouse was the proper place to do that. And in fact, we could undertake a process called adaptive rehabilitation to update that building, to turn it into a state-of-the-art visitor center with a full complement of exhibits, a place to screen the new park film, all while preserving the look and the feel of that historic warehouse that was at one point used to support a camp that housed, you know, more than 13,000 people in it, again, during the period of incarceration.
Hanako, you're as I mentioned, you're the chief of interpretation and education at Minidoka. So for you, what were you able to, you know, redesign or maybe expand on from an educational standpoint for, you know, for that visitor experience?
Yeah, the one main thing that I really want to focus on is to contextualize the history. Because a lot of people, when they think about just World War II history or the Japanese American incarceration experience, they only look at it in the vacuum of World War II, not recognizing that there were some systemic issues that occurred in the 1800s that led to this environment for this to happen. So contextualizing the history is really important to understand, and also to make sure that people understand that these were not Imperial Japanese soldiers who were here, because there's a lot of confusion, because there was Camp Rupert nearby that actually held German soldiers from the war front that were brought out. So there is some local confusion that people who were incarcerated at Minidoka were POWs, which was not the case. They were actually Japanese nationals who were barred by law from becoming naturalized citizens until the 50s is when that finally got overturned for Asian immigrants and their American-born children. And it's because of the racism that existed that people were fearing that somehow there's some collusion. That's what led to the incarceration. But one thing that I always like to help people understand this is that just because Japanese Americans, you know, ethnically, they look like the so-called enemy, you know, we have to look at it through the other lens. Like, how ridiculous would it be if we were to say any German Americans during World War II was somehow complicit in the Holocaust? That's the same reasoning that people were putting on Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals in the US with the incarceration. But we didn't do a mass incarceration of German and Italian Americans. There was actually people who were incarcerated, but they were charged with espionage and sabotage. And if they were convicted, they were incarcerated. Japanese Americans did not have the due process. There was no one who was ever convicted. So that's the important aspect, is contextualizing the history, understanding that there were civil rights violations that occurred, and how we need to protect our constitution, because a lot of civil servants at the time did not uphold their oath of duty.
And Mia, what do you want park visitors to get out of this experience when they visit Minidoka?
You know, I was raised in Boise and Hanako was as well, and both being of, you know, Japanese American ancestry, we both didn't learn about this history until college. And in my case, it was out of state. And it's just a shock that we don't learn this in Idaho history. It's a huge part of our history in our state, but also hugely important to the national story of what was happening on the home front during World War II. So my biggest hope is that people will understand the full story, as Hanako explained, but also have empathy and be changed and understand their role in continuing to uphold our civil liberties. And also just to make sure that everyone learns this story, because for 75 years, we really haven't talked about it in Idaho.
Well, and I would venture to say that it's something that we haven't talked about as a society in the United States. I grew up in Washington State, and there was an internment camp there. I did not learn about that, like you, Mia, until college, right? And so Wade, I'm curious about your thoughts on the interest that you're seeing. I mean, are people wanting to come and visit, you know, and learn this history about our country?
I think absolutely. There's a growing interest and desire, and I think that we're seeing it in terms of people making their way to the site. I think that we're seeing it in every year. It seems that the annual pilgrimage, which me and Hanako might wish to speak about, gets a little larger. It's generally a four-day event put on by a partner group that welcomes survivors of the incarceration, their family and friends, and others who are interested to come back. Visitation to our webpage, social media, and then some new and innovative things that we're doing this year. Hanako and Mia and a large number of partners put together what they called a virtual pilgrimage, which encompassed all of the sites that unjustly incarcerated Japanese Americans during the Second World War, and offered a full complement of programming, stories, and the full gamut. So I think it is growing. I think that people are understanding just how fragile our democracy can be, that the stories of Minidoka have relevance to what we're doing today. And there's a lot of lessons there. And I think there's a growing interest in that.
Before I wrap up, I'm curious, Hanako and Mia, you know, this project took quite a bit of time, but I imagine there's more that you would like to see done. Do you have any other projects coming forward with Minidoka?
I can speak to that real quick. You know, so much of our time in the last 20 years has been getting the site ready to represent the story of what happened there. So in the past, Friends of Minidoka took on a lot of historic reconstruction projects of the honor roll and the guard tower at the entrance area and a baseball field. And we recently did an Issei Memorial exhibit to honor the first generation of immigrants in the new visitor center. But I think for us, we'll see a shift in our work tied to our mission and really getting that education piece in play with the visitor center being able to open and welcome people. And we are finishing up a 1-hour documentary, hopefully to broadcast on public television next year. And accompanying that, we are working on study guides, 7th through 12th grade, free online educational curriculum. So I think in the future, we'll really head into that education realm and make sure that folks are coming to the site and know that these resources are available, but that they're also available for folks all throughout Idaho and nationwide. So we're really excited to take that next step and be able to tell that story in people's living rooms and classrooms.
Yeah, I want to thank all...
To follow up on that is that, you know, partnerships is a real big thing because, you know, at our site, you know, we are a small staff. And so partnering with like Friends of Minidoka, the Minidoka Pilgrimage Planning Committee, or the Japanese American Memorial Pilgrimages allows us to kind of have more capacity to do more programming. And I see some of our shift is going to go a little bit more online, like what Wade kind of mentioned about our virtual pilgrimage. We had, you know, over, and it's still counting right now, it's like 120,000 participants. And those are individual participants for that program, even though it finished over a month ago. And, you know, we worked with Central Michigan University to do a 360 tour, and I could share that link with you if you want. So other people could go visit our visitor center if they're unable to actually make the trek out.
And that was my October interview with the folks behind the renovation of a Minidoka historical site building. We'll have more Idaho Matters right after this.